Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream, in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Coming up on the programme today, we'll have more on that breaking news that dozens of Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon have been injured by their pagers exploding. That's a story just broken in the past hour or so. But we lead the programme today with a disturbing story from southeastern France, from Mazan, which has shocked the country, and a warning, it is harrowing and graphic, but it's opened up an important conversation in France and elsewhere about sexual consent and sex-based violence. Today, 71-year-old Dominic Pellicot has been testifying in court. He's at the centre of a mass rape trial. He's accused of repeatedly drugging his former wife, Giselle, without her knowledge and systematically raping her over many years. What makes this story all the more disturbing is that he's accused of arranging dozens of other men to also rape her while she was unconscious and therefore unable to consent. 50 men are co-accused and will face their own trials. But today, Dominic Pellicot admitted to the crimes against him and begged for forgiveness. Speaking to reporters outside the court in Avignon, his lawyer, Beatrice Zavaro, said Mr. Pellicot was repentant.
I've just seen him and he is obviously very downcast. He asked his wife to forgive him for everything that happened. I don't know what Mrs. Pellicot will decide to do with this request and this proposal, but whatever happens, that's where he is. He will continue. Let's say that it's a confessional. We know that he will continue for sure. There's no fear about that. I think we'll go to the end of this trial and we will know everything about Dominic Pellicot.
Well, earlier I spoke to Dr. Andrea Gruev-Vintilla. She's an expert in social psychology, coercive control and gender violence at Université Paris-Nanterre. And she began by telling me what Mr. Pellicot had said in court today.
Today, the husband of Giselle Pellicot, Dominic Pellicot, admitted his deeds. He tried to minimize them. Of course, he tried to self-excuse by reminding that he was a victim of sexual abuse during childhood. But we shouldn't be misled, because if perpetrators committed abuse because they have been abused during childhood, then the main perpetrators would be women, because those who are the most abused during childhood and later in life, it's in fact women, and they are not most of the perpetrators.
Well, and of course, many people who are the victims of abuse in childhood never go on to be abusers themselves. You mention his ex-wife, Giselle, there. She was also in court today, and she did speak, didn't she? I mean, it was actually her that requested that this trial was open to the public to raise awareness, which it seems to be an immense act of courage from her. What did she say today?
She thanked all the people who mobilized in France, because we had huge mobilizations in different cities in France in support to her and all the victims, with people rallying the cry, La honte doit changer de camp, shame must change sides. So she thanked everyone for the support. She said she felt responsible for other victims. And it's important to salute her tremendous courage to have the doors open for her trial and to make sure that the shame does change sides.
This is a story that has shocked the country, and it is extraordinary in one way, in how awful it is. But one of the shocking things about it is how ordinary many of the perpetrators yes. seem to have been. Has that been part of the story with all of this?
There were voices in France, important feminist voices and important voices of victims of other sexual abuse, including from celebrities, that finally spoke about the rape culture that we may be living in. In any event, this case prompts discussions about how French law should better address rape, marital rape, coercive control, and potentially leading to legal reforms similar to those in other countries where coercive control has been criminalized.
You mentioned big-name feminists in France that have been speaking out on this. There was a group outside the court today, and mm-hmm. one of those speaking was Anicia Ducaigne, and this is what she had to say.
There's perhaps a symbolic dimension to the fact that we are finally talking about what rape is, and that we're realizing that the accused, so the 50 men who were found, because once again, there are 30 who are at large, who we haven't been able to identify, are in fact ordinary people of all ages, between 20 and 70, who have all sorts of jobs, who are good fathers, who are integrated into society. Let's face it, that's what rape is all about. It's not about a madman, a monster, a dropout or a degenerate. No, they are just Mr. Ordinary.
And that was a leading feminist speaking outside the court. And in fact, among those who are charged, there's a fireman, a nurse, a prison guard, mm-hmm. a journalist. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are mm-hmm. ordinary men, some with families mm-hmm. of their own.
Absolutely. It really shows the banality of rape and of marital rape. It really shows how much women are being objectified in France and with which passivity from bystanders, from us, from the larger society. We needed this trial, and in fact, within this trial, what would have been the destiny of this trial had we not had the videos recorded? Would Gisèle Pelicot have been, would she be believed for what she went through? The other point, important point, is that the case, the Mazin case, has professional implications because Gisèle Pelicot has seen doctors, has seen medical professionals, and none of the professionals whom she saw connected between the symptoms and what may be chemical submission. There is a very beautiful paper by French philosopher Camille Fradon-Maitry about the professional the responsibility of professionals in these cases. It really underscores the need for better training among legal, medical, and social work professionals to recognize and respond to marital rape, domestic violence, and of course, coercive control. And the other thing is that the Mazin trial may represent the beginning of a turning point in French culture that challenges the deeply ingrained attitude about gender, power, and violence in intimate relationships.
You talk about the drugging there. She didn't know she was being drugged for all those years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the questions are, as you say there, the number of men who were prepared to take part in this yes. and to effectively rape her, feeling themselves or not questioning that and continuing with that.
Absolutely, feeling entitled to take advantage of a woman's body as if it was an object.
What do you think this has done to the local community?
Actually, the people from Mazin are convinced that everyone else sees their place as a raper's place. Of course, it's a place like any other place in France, except that the light was put on Mazin. This is their feeling today, and that the community is under a bad light. But the Mazin trial will probably stay in history as a powerful catalyst for change in French society's understanding and response to marital rape, domestic violence, and coercive control.
Social psychologist Dr. Andrea Gruev-Vintilla there. Now, the crisis in Sudan is not getting enough attention or international help, the head of the World Health Organization says. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has just been on a visit to Sudan and the surrounding border region with Chad. Around 12 million people have been displaced since the civil war broke out in Sudan in April last year. Half the population, that's about 25 million people, is facing acute food shortages. Dr. Tedros told my BBC colleague Michelle Hussein that Sudan and other African conflicts were being overlooked by the world's community. He says there's a pattern.
Situation in Sudan is very, very alarming. You know about the massive displacement. It's now the largest in the world. And of course, famine. Imagine destruction, displacement, and now famine. That's so tragic. When I was in Sudan, actually, I visited a camp for IDPs. And also, I have visited a hospital, and you see there many children, skin and bone. Starvation is almost everywhere. So the scale is really big. And as you know, half of the population needs support now, which is close to 25 million of the total population. And that's really big. And 12 million of the population is already displaced, 10 million internally, and more than 2 million who fled the country. So it's really tragic, and the attention it gets from the international community is really low. It's not getting the attention it deserves. And I have seen it all, and I will continue to speak about it. I think Sudan deserves to be the center of attention.
Why do you think it isn't?
That's the sad part, because you see it repeatedly. It's not just Sudan, but you see it in other areas. You remember when there was war in Tigray, Ethiopia, I made the same comment. It was a very tragic war. The number of people killed is even more than what you see now in Sudan. And the level of rape was in tens of thousands. My observation is when it comes to South, especially in Africa, and I think the attention is really, really low.
Is race a factor in that? And I ask that because I think you did some time ago say that you wondered whether the world gives equal attention to black and white lives. And you were thinking on the one hand about Ethiopia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, and you were contrasting that with concern for Ukraine.
Exactly. I think race is in the play here. That's what I feel now, because we see the pattern now. It's a pattern. And today I was on the border, Adre, and we actually dispatched convoys from Adre to Darfur. And I have visited some camps there. And I met mothers who told me that they have worked actually for 18 days with children. And the camps we have visited, more than 94% are women and children. So where is humanity, you would ask? You know, of course, there is some support, but it's so limited. It's a token compared to the magnitude. I think it's nothing. So that's what I worry now. Is it really a race issue that nobody gives attention and you see tragedy? I think we have to see this and understand it.
And money flows from, money and funding flows from attention, doesn't it? I wonder how much funding the projects that you as WHO or the work that you want to carry out in Sudan, how much funding you have for those? Is there a shortfall?
Yeah, funding is an issue because if you take, for instance, the level of funding for the crisis in Sudan, it's very small compared to the need. So it's with increased attention, then you can have more finance as well. So when I say international community, it's governments, it's donors, but at the same time, it's also media and the mainstream media, I think should give it more attention because it's really a tragedy.
Dr. Tedros from the WHO there. Now, still to come, 15 years after US forces were asked to leave Ecuador, its new president says he wants them back to help fight the drug gangs. We'll hear from a former vice president.
The harder you fight drug gangs, the more violence you have. So it's a hard choice. As a leader, as a government, it's a hard choice. But you have to make one. This is a transnational and multinational problem. Drug trafficking, it's not an Ecuador-only problem. And all help you can get from any country that really wants to help must be welcome. And I think that's positive.
More on that to come. And our headline this hour, dozens of Hezbollah fighters in southern Lebanon are reported to have been wounded by their pagers exploding in what the group has called its biggest ever security breach. More on that in just a moment. With NewsHour live from the BBC, I'm Rebecca Kesby. Now, reports have been coming in within the past hour or so of a series of explosions in and around Beirut. It seems pager devices belonging to members of the armed militia Hezbollah have exploded and injured those wearing them. It comes on the same day that Israel announced the expansion of its war aims to focus on Hezbollah along its northern border with Lebanon. Well, the BBC's security correspondent Frank Gardner joins us live in the studio. Frank, what do we know about the circumstances on this today?
Well, what's being reported is that initially dozens, now possibly hundreds of members of Hezbollah, not just fighters, but medics and other people in civilian clothes, not in uniform, not necessarily carrying weapons, but they all had these new pagers which had been purchased in the last 3 months by Hezbollah, which is the Iranian-backed militia, the most powerful military force in Lebanon and certainly the most powerful non-state army in the entire Middle East, which is effectively at war, at a low-level war with Israel and has been for some time. They all got these pagers, which appeared to explode almost simultaneously with some pretty serious injuries. There's some very bloody pictures online of people. Now, there's no comment initially from Israel, but there's no question that that Hezbollah blames Israel for this. They've called it an absolutely heinous act and lots of other expletives. It started in the Hezbollah-dominated suburb of Dahiya, which is in southern Beirut. That's their kind of stronghold. And I have to say that, I mean, the suspicion is, of course, that in some way Israel's intelligence agencies, either Mossad or Shin Bet, will have somehow hacked into these devices. Goodness knows technically how they're able to do it. But I'm old enough that this reminds me of the assassination in January 1996 it was assumed by Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency, of somebody called Yahya Ayash, who was known as al-Muhandis, the engineer. He was the chief bomb maker for Hamas at the time. He had trained a large number of suicide bombers, and he was assassinated by a mobile phone that blew up and killed him.
So that was one incident. But from what you're saying, it sounds as if hundreds of people have been affected.
They have been. This is right across the board. And so, you know, it's a crisis not just for Hezbollah, but for Lebanon. So, you know, the government is saying it's called on medics to rush to hospitals to help all these wounded who are coming in, but also telling their own medics, who are nothing to do with Hezbollah, do not, if you've got a pager, don't use it.
Goodness. So, I mean, a fair amount of chaos there. But you talk about the state of Lebanon. It's battling all sorts of economic and statewide problems of its own. Does it have the capacity to deal with this kind of number of injuries?
Well, yes, it will do. And a lot, there'll be citizens donating blood and, you know, there'll be a lot of citizen help in this. But I mean, Lebanon's problems are, as you say, chronic and profound because its economy was already in a bad way. It used to be a very popular destination for wealthy Gulf Arab holidaymakers, particularly Saudis. They had properties in the mountains. They loved going there because it was the perfect combination of fantastic food, Arabic language, and beautiful scenery. But sadly, Lebanon has been in a state of conflict for quite some time. There is an ongoing low-level war that is being fought on that northern border between Lebanon and Israel. On the Israeli side, roughly 60,000 citizens have been pushed out of their homes and are living in hotels. They can't go back to their homes and farmlands. On the Lebanese side, more people have been killed than on the Israeli side, and a greater number have been displaced.
And Frank, you mentioned that it's thought that most of these pages, or all these pages, had been issued recently. Do we know where they came from?
This is so new, this news, that I don't if somebody does know, well, somebody must know, but I don't know. But the suspicion will be that they have been tampered with at source. I think it's very unlikely that they were remotely tampered with. Mm. Somebody somehow must have got in there and put something in there. I mean, it's an extraordinary bit of mass sabotage.
Well, thank you very much for coming in with the latest there. That's the BBC security correspondent, Frank Gardner, live with that news that in the past hour or so a series of explosions have happened in and around Beirut and that Hezbollah fighters have been targeted there via their pagers. Now let's move on, because extensive flooding in central Europe has claimed at least 18 lives so far and caused major damage and disruption. In Poland, a state of disaster has been declared in the worst affected areas and the entire population of one town, Nysan, has been told to evacuate. That's around 44,000 people. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has sent us this report from one Polish town near the Czech border.
That's the sound of the river here smacking up against the wreckage of the main bridge in this town that collapsed under the sheer pressure of the floodwater. It's now a huge mess with massive tree trunks across it and chunks of concrete and metal. The water is still moving extremely quickly, rushing past me. But the level has fallen, and as it has, the floodwater in this town has receded, and what it's left behind in Głuchołazy is a terrible mess of mud and rubbish.
It's very dark. Just walking through the mud into this gentleman's house. Dzień dobry.
Dzień dobry. Tu miałem zalane.
There, everything is water inside. Okay.
Is this the first time you've come back?
Yes. Everything from children, everything is damaged. 1 month ago was everything completely new.
You just did repairs here, just decorated?
Yes. Yeah, everything, money, what we have, was from the repair, and now we don't have nothing.
Hey, Natalia.
Hello.
When the water came, were you here?
I and my family fast ran.
What did you see?
Water, everything.
Just water everywhere. Was it scary when it was coming?
Yes. I'm scared.
The problem when you're trying to get around a flooded town is that it's almost impossible to get through anywhere. And we came across this way before. Some people had put some wooden pallets down and we managed to cross the water, but they seem to have been washed away. I'm not quite sure how we get back.
In the main market square here, the cobblestones have been torn up. And just in front of me, there's also a vehicle which is nose down in a big hole in the pavement. It's obviously been thrown here by the power of the water. It's going to take a long time, obviously, to clean all this mess up. And we've just heard that the sirens have gone off again in some of the towns near here because one of the dams nearby has been breached. And the danger is that there will be more water heading this way.
And that was Sarah Rainsford, our Eastern Europe correspondent, with that report from Poland, but also Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, all bracing for the worst as the floodwaters rush towards them from the River Danube.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, Download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Malaysia's had an extraordinary economic success in the past 30 years, but now its population is ageing fast and despite its development, growing numbers of elderly people are at risk of poverty because they don't have pensions or enough savings to live on into old age. Claire Balderson reports from Kuala Lumpur.
It's Saturday evening in central Kuala Lumpur, and at the Kachara Soup Kitchen, volunteers are preparing food parcels for distribution on the streets of the Malaysian capital. There are plastic boxes filled with noodles or rice and crates of fresh fruit and bread rolls.
The majority of the people receiving food from our soup kitchen, 60% of them are actually over the age of 60.
Justin Chia is one of the charity's most senior and long-serving members of staff.
They are literally stranded, living every day, just looking for their next meal, paying for their next day of rent. Yeah.
At the soup kitchen's outreach station on a street corner, I meet Mr. Lim, who's 68 but looks much older.
He's 68 and he has a problem with his health. He has knees problem and I'm unable to find a job, so he has to be here to get food.
Mr. Lim was a construction worker in the private sector. There are no state pensions for people like him. Instead, private sector workers, the majority of the labour force, have something called the Employees Provident Fund, or EPF, which is more like a retirement savings account.
By the age of 55, you can withdraw the entire pension fund, and that is just very minimal for a wage worker. So he said he already spent it.
So he already spent the pension?
Yes.
It's all gone?
Yes.
It's not uncommon in Malaysia for employees to quickly use up their EPF funds. People are living longer, but they're not saving more. And according to the EPF, only about 18% of account holders have anywhere near enough for a secure retirement. So why is it so hard to put money aside? Professor Norma Mansour is director of the Social Wellbeing Research Centre at the University of Malaya.
In the past 30, 40 years, wages were low, so savings were very low. So the current generation of 60s and older, quite a big percentage of them do not have the kind of savings that you would require to support you during old age.
You know, Malaysia's had fantastic development, and yet the social safety net doesn't seem to have kept up. Is there an imbalance between those two things?
I think the approach, Claire, in Malaysia is always that it was about employment. Employment is seen as a safety net, and also you can rely on your family members in case of crisis.
Relying on family for support worked while Malaysia was a youthful country with fewer old people and five or six children per family. But in a modern urbanised economy, there are clear signs that the traditional safety net is under strain.
And that report from Claire Balderson. And if you'd like more on that story, do tune in to this week's assignment on the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's head back to that breaking story now from Lebanon. It's a very fluid situation, but more details are emerging. Hundreds of members of the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah have been injured. This is after handheld pagers that they used to communicate exploded. It seems around the same time, Lebanon's state news agency says there were blasts in the southern suburb of Beirut and other areas as well. And we are seeing reports, and this is just on one source at the moment coming from Iranian news sources, that the Iranian ambassador to Beirut is among those injured. That, as I say, just on one source and from Iranian sources at the moment. Let's cross now live to Beirut, where we find Wael Taleb, who's a journalist from the Lebanese English language newspaper L'Orient. Thanks so much for coming on. I mean, what can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, so basically, like, my office is around Beirut, so we didn't hear anything. And even people who were in like Beirut south and suburbs, for example, which is a Hezbollah stronghold, not all of them heard like explosions. What appears to be what happened, now everyone has an idea about it, is that the pagers that Hezbollah members and fighters use, they were they exploded. It appears to be a very sophisticated operation, assumingly by Israel, targeting mostly Hezbollah fighters. We have over 1,000 wounded right now, and the number is 1,000 to become
1,000 wounded, you're saying?
Over 1,000 wounded, yes.
Okay, and just
the number. Yes.
Sorry, just to your point, we actually haven't heard from the Israeli government at this point. I know that that's where Hezbollah is pointing the finger, but we haven't heard from them whether they were involved. But yes, I mean, 1,000 casualties so far. How are the local hospitals coping with that?
Exactly. But just to comment on your point, you are right. Officially, Israel has not claimed the operation. But in previous big operations, like the Saleh Haruri assassination, they also did not claim the operation. That's why I said assumingly, like not
understood.
Officially.
Understood, yeah. So tell us about the attempt to get people to hospital. Sorry, we lost your line. Yeah. Carry on.
Yes, no. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay, sorry, because the people are calling each other, so the lines are actually affected. Yes, so like on the streets, you hear ambulances everywhere around Beirut. The security forces are asking people to stay off the road to allow the ambulances to move around. The health minister asked every doctor, every nurse to come to the hospitals to provide help. The situation is actually insane right now.
Well, we've seen some pictures that are going around online, and it does seem as if some of these injuries are really quite serious.
Yes. I mean, we haven't seen plenty of reports about death. Right now, the reports are about casualties. I assume that because a pager, when it explodes, it wouldn't necessarily cause the death of someone, but so many injuries across Lebanon, we're speaking. Like in the introduction, we said, in Beirut south and suburbs, which is a Hezbollah stronghold. But yeah, across Lebanon, there are places where Hezbollah fighters are residing. They are residents of those places. So
you mentioned the government of Israel. Of course, it does come on the day that the Israeli government did announce that it wanted to expand its war aims to focus on Hezbollah along its northern border. Have the government in Beirut had anything to say so far, or advice for, you know, people, local people?
Not really, actually, because it's mainly because we've been living in this situation for almost a year now. It's always like Lebanon is on the edge, on the verge of a full-scale war. The South has experienced the war since October 7, the South and Lebanon. What would the government do? Ask people to get out of their country? If a full-scale war were to happen, there's nothing they can do about it. The government has taken the position of detaching itself from what Hezbollah is doing. It did not adopt what Hezbollah has been doing in terms of operations, but that's what they did for the most part.
Okay. Well,
just to give context, there's no shelters in Lebanon which people can decide to. We have seen a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of southern residents displaced, southern Lebanese, displaced from their villages, yes. I personally, for example, I live in Beirut's southern suburbs, which is a Hezbollah stronghold. Me and many others have moved away from that area, at least when things get tense and when they are on the verge of expanding, escalating.
Wael Taleb, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on that dramatic and moving story. I think there has been advice from the government for people to discard any pager that they may had. And that news again, dozens, well, hundreds it seems, and our guest there saying 1,000 Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon have been injured by their pagers exploding. That news just happening now. Now, the president of Ecuador, Daniel Noboa, has set out a new proposal to change the constitution so that foreign military bases would be allowed to operate in the country again. It's 15 years since US soldiers left the country and handed control of their base to the Ecuadorian authorities. But the country's seen a surge in violence, with powerful armed gangs and transnational drug cartels taking over various aspects of life in Ecuador. So is allowing foreign military involvement in the country a good idea? I've been speaking to former Vice President of Ecuador between 2018 and 20, Otto Ramon Sonnenholzner.
Politically, it is, and you have elections coming soon next February, and you have a government that is having issues to keep up its popularity. In terms of solving the violence, it's not about having military personnel, its presence in the country. It's more about having access to technology and equipment. That's why I say that all cooperation is welcome from the U.S. or from anywhere. We do have the military personnel that is trained and that is ready for the fight, and the police personnel as well. But we do need equipment for intelligence, for logistics, for air control. And that equipment is expensive. So what we normally get from cooperating countries is, I don't know, secondhand equipment, stuff that they are not really using. That doesn't involve having or not having military bases. I don't think you lose any sovereignty, as the opposition to the government would say, if you have military bases. I don't think that it's necessary. That's only, I don't think that it's what we need right now. What we need right now is equipment, help, intelligence. Listen, help in money laundering. Most of the, or many of the gangs are laundering their money also abroad. In 2009, when President Correa decided to expel the American base from Manta, Ecuador lost its operational capabilities to control its maritime space, and it didn't replace that air surveillance of the Pacific Ocean with anything. In 2019, without having to bring back foreign bases, we recovered the control of the airspace on the Pacific Ocean. With that, the increase of the seizures of cocaine was exponential. But also, when you increase the capture of drugs, you have violence rising. And that's where Ecuador is right now.
Well, you say it's politically popular. And I guess that's because of the grip the country's in from the gangs and the drug cartels and so on. I mean, we've had huge prison breaks just this year. We had a television station taken over earlier on this year as well. And people in Ecuador are absolutely terrified of these armed groups and the grip they have in the country.
Yeah, Ecuador went from having around 6 violent deaths every 100,000 citizens to around 50 last year. So it's also an exponential increase. But the more drugs you capture, the harder you fight drug gangs, the more violence you have. So it's a hard choice. As a leader, as a government, it's a hard choice. You have to make one. This is a transnational and multinational problem. Drug trafficking, it's not an Ecuador-only problem. And all help you can get from any country that really wants to help must be welcome. And I think that's positive. But that having foreign bases in Ecuador will be part of the solution, I'm not sure about that.
But in terms of having foreign soldiers in the country, how popular might that be?
Around 80% of the people, it makes a correlation between the expulsion of the U.S. military base and the drug trafficking issue in Ecuador. And that correlation is not wrong in terms of having had the country for 10 years without any control, any real control of the Pacific Ocean, of the maritime space. So yeah, that was an open invitation for drug gangs to establish themselves in Ecuador. That together with a thing called universal citizenship, no real border control in terms of migration. And that was an open invitation also for drug cartels from all around the world. And when I say all around the world, I really mean it. I mean, this is from Italy, Albania, Mexico, Colombia. It's like from Asia, from Eastern Europe. You have all those drug cartels, all those operations having a logistics and operational center in around Guayaquil mostly, which is the maritime port. And let me explain this briefly. What happened with drug trafficking, especially cocaine trafficking? The U.S. has reduced its demand on cocaine. They have replaced it with other synthetic drugs. And the demand for cocaine increased in Europe. So ports, maritime ports in South America that have containers became popular for drug gangs. So Guayaquil in Ecuador is the biggest banana port in the world. That makes it as well very attractive for drug gangs. That's why you have the violence concentrated in Guayaquil.
So on the subject of it being an international issue, do you know if there's an appetite, certainly from the United States, to be involved again, actually inside Ecuador? I mean, I know that there was a delegation, I think, earlier this year from the U.S. Southern Command. This was Army General Laura Richardson, I think, made a trip to Ecuador. But do you think there would be appetite from the United States to help Ecuador with this?
Again, in 2019, we recovered the cooperation with the U.S. and started flying these satellite planes to regain control on the Pacific Ocean. So there has been cooperation lately, and it has been positive in terms of increasing the cocaine seizures. The problem is that the more drug you capture, and if you don't have an institutional governmental plan to take care of so many big social issues, the more violence you will have.
You mentioned the elections next year that are scheduled. How important is it that these elections work and that the population still believes in democracy and still believes in the rule of law and the rule of government in a country like Ecuador when it's in the grip of the gangs?
You see, that's a big question, I think, not only in Ecuador, but worldwide. You have a polarized society, politicians talking for the algorithms more than for the people, you know, and the algorithms in social media, they prioritize conflict, they prioritize polarization, and I think that's what's happening. Politicians are adapting to those algorithms, and nowadays that's the way to reach people, and you reach them in the wrong way, in my opinion.
Otto Ramon Sonnenholzner, their former vice president of Ecuador, speaking to us earlier today. Now, ever since the pandemic, workers from all over the world have been debating whether it's better to work from home or the office, or maybe a bit of both. But many employers have now been demanding workers do head back to the office, including now the tech giant Amazon. The chief exec of Amazon, Andy Jassy, has told hundreds of thousands of its global e-commerce workforce, in other words, the ones not working in the warehouses, that they'll be required to work full time in the office from the start of next year. Well, to discuss all this, earlier I spoke to Laura Hegarty, who was working from home for global recruiting company Indeed, and also Paul Swinney, Director of Policy and Research at the UK think tank Centre for Cities. He was in the office. So let's start with Paul. Make the case for working in the office.
I think there are two or three main benefits. I think one is that there's the chance to collaborate with colleagues and come up with new creative ways of doing things, which is not impossible on online platforms, but it is harder definitely to do. The second one is the ability to learn new skills from colleagues who've been in the industry 10, 15, 20 years, you know, by sitting next to them and hearing them how to deal with clients and tricky conversations and situations. You learn how to deal with those things, which if you're sat on your own in your back bedroom or your kitchen, you just totally miss that happening. I think the third is the frictions that you have around communications as well. So you know, if you're together face-to-face, there's just so much more information you can read in terms of reading people's body language, etc., which just allows things to work just a little bit better by having everybody in the same room.
OK, Laura Hegarty, listening to that and standing by, what's the opposing view?
Hi, Rebecca. Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic. So Indeed is a global hiring platform, and that gives us this front row seat to 350 million job seekers looking for work each month. And we're matching them with opportunities. And I think we know from this that the demand for flexible work is being driven by workers. So we have a few indicators pointing to that. So from a survey we ran this year, we found that over a third of job seekers say that they wouldn't take a role if it did not offer flexible working. And that matches with data from the platform. So to give you an idea, remote or hybrid work is mentioned in around 15% of Indeed job postings in countries such as the UK, Germany and Ireland.
Paul, this isn't just about flexibility. Lots of people talk about trying to manage families, bring up children, other caring responsibilities. But it also does benefit maybe some disabled workers who find it easier to work from home where they've got access to everything that they need there. Or people who just want to avoid office politics, people who think it's more productive to be at home and focusing without all the chatter about what happened on the TV last night.
Well, if we deal with the latter first, on the productivity point, I mean, this is the crux of the argument. Are you more productive at home or are you more productive at work? And I think a number of people think they are more productive at home. I think they view that as being, I can sit down, I can get through this, my long to-do list of things that I personally need to do, and I don't get disturbed. And I totally get that. But the role of somebody, you know, in their workplace isn't just, here's the to-do list and get through your to-do list. It's also, how do you mentor somebody else? How do you go and fix somebody's problems if they've got a problem? Or indeed, how can they help you fix your problem if you have a problem too? So there's this sort of broader spillover almost of being in the office. Like, it isn't just you're a commodity there to run through a list of problems, but you're actually there to work as a team. And I think that is more difficult to do. Now, there are some exceptions to that. You know, people who have disabilities or maybe neurodiversity, for example, they clearly, you know, would benefit, I think, more so from a home location than perhaps other workers. But I don't think the conversation should be framed about that. We should be just having a conversation about how do we help them to work best and then how do we help the other parts of the workforce to work best too.
But also it's about individual personality too, isn't it? And also the task that you've got to do. Sometimes maybe it is better to be in the office. Sometimes it's better to work from home. And isn't a bit of flexibility the best thing? I mean, this is a political spat that's going on in the UK at the moment, and the new government, the business secretary, says it's got plans to introduce new flexible working laws here in the UK. What do you make of that, Laura?
Yeah, I think flexibility comes in lots of different forms. And of course, some employers are able to offer this hybrid remote working and others may not be. But there are lots of different ways to offer that. So thinking about flexi time, part-time hours, job sharing, things like that, it doesn't just have to be working remotely or hybridly. But we do know that this has a disproportionate positive impact on women in work. So a piece of research that we did with the Hybrid Work Commission last year, companies like CIPD and Vodafone, we were asserting in that report that hybrid work is probably here to stay. We found that women that mainly work from home are much more likely to work full time than those that work mainly away from home. And that's even more the case in households with dependent children. And, you know, focus group of one here, but I can attest to the fact that as a mum with two young children, I am able to work full time with the hybrid setup that I currently find with my employer Indeed.
A lot of people talk about mental health, don't they? And people make the case for it being better for a work-life balance working from home. But I guess there is also the case, Paul, for mental health being better if you're in a more social group, if you have to get out of the house, if your home isn't your office all the time as well.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the issue for younger workers, that have they got the appropriate home space to be able to do their job properly, particularly living house shares. And there are elements of whether if people are working, you know, isolated for long periods of time, what impact that has on their mental health. So there's definitely, you know, arguments in both ways on that front, that we think there's more work to be done around that. But I think the overall, the element is, you know, are we more productive or are we not? And I think there's a large body of evidence pre-pandemic to suggest that we should be wary of, you know, longer term costs of that might creep up on us if we do have large amounts of isolated working and implications that has for skill development, for pay and for progression, which are things you don't see immediately today.
All right. So there's obviously large areas of disagreement between you two. But is there a consensus that actually work itself has changed since the pandemic? Laura?
Yes, absolutely. I think the pandemic made us rethink lots of things about our life. We know from our research that after your family and your health or work or your work or your job is one of the most important things in your life. And okay. I think the fact that those things now shape each other really impacts the way that we think about flexible work.
Briefly, Paul.
Well, if you look at the trajectory, it's quite interesting because, you know, in 2020, we were being told that we're all going to work from home forever and the genie was out of the bottle. And yet in London, it's now 2.7 days a week in work. In Paris, it's 3.5.
Paul Swinney and Laura Hegarty there, and our thanks to them. That's it from us. But do stay tuned for the news, which will have the latest from Lebanon and that breaking news that hundreds of Hezbollah fighters have been injured by their pagers exploding. It's thought that Iran's ambassador to Lebanon is among the injured. That story breaking within the past hour or so. More coming up on the news, which is next.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.